Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Michael Hudson, senior editor with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, who talks about his group's groundbreaking investigation, Secrecy for Sale, inside the global offshore money maze. Adam Green of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, who discusses his group's threat to launch primary campaigns against congressional Democrats who support President Obama's proposed cuts to Social Security and Medicare benefits. And defense attorney Diane Polin describes the unusual case of J.O. Richardson, who, charged with assault on a police officer, avoided conviction because members of the jury believed the police had broken the law. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, claims children in Britain face a stark future due to massive budget cuts in youth services imposed by the current conservative liberal coalition government. The UNICEF report, which ranks the well-being of children in 29 industrial nations, blamed a 26% reduction in funds for children and youth services in the United Kingdom for the declining status of young people. The UN agency says 400,000 children in Britain are now at risk of falling into poverty over the next 3 years. UNICEF UK Assistant Director Anita Thiessen told The Guardian, "There is no doubt the situation for children and youth has deteriorated. In the last year, the government has made policy choices that risk setting back children in their most serious stage of development." Scandinavian nations, including the Netherlands and Finland, ranked highest in the UNICEF scale for child well-being. The bottom of the list of developed countries included the United States and former Soviet states like Latvia and Greece. Last fall, the relief group Save the Children ran its first domestic fundraising campaign in Britain to aid families hard hit by the recession and the government's harsh austerity cuts. Since the 1950s, U.S. aid to the world's hungry has been tied to boosting U.S. agribusiness profits and shipping American-grown grain to feed the poor. But this system, supported by agribusiness, shipping interests, and a few aid groups, is slow and expensive in delivering critical food aid to starving nations. The biggest winners in the current food aid system are large grain companies such as Arthur Daniels Midland, Cargill, and Bunge Limited. Starting in the 1990s, anti-hunger activists urged donor reforms that would provide cash to buy emergency food supplies. The European Union reformed its food aid program in 1996, and Canada ended its tied aid system in 2010. In their 2014 budget, the Obama administration proposes reforms that would end requirements that American food aid be purchased and shipped from the U.S. Instead, more funding would be available to buy food closer to where it's needed. The reforms also propose moving control over food aid from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. USAID estimates that the reforms, if implemented, would allow food aid to reach an additional 2 to 4 million hungry people each year. Under the 1986 Federal Immigration Reform and Control Act, 2.7 million undocumented immigrants won temporary legal status, and 1 million immigrants became U.S. citizens. Most of the new citizens were Mexican natives. Other laws specifically aided legalization of Chinese students after Tiananmen Square and Haitians in 1988. Since 1960, over 1 million Cuban emigres have won permanent legal status in the U.S. According to the Christian Science Monitor, a 2004 study concluded the most important impact from the 1986 law was the ability of legal immigrants to boost their earning power anywhere from 6% to 13% in the same job. 5 years after the law was enacted, the Migration Policy Institute found legalized immigrants had moved into better-paying careers. As the U.S. Congress engages in debate on new proposals to reform the nation's immigration laws, Donald Kerwin of the Center for Migration Studies points out that some of the more than 11 million undocumented immigrants currently living in the U.S. have actually gone through the first phase of the immigration application process, but have been ensnared in backlogs, waiting years to attain legal status. They're not trying to cut the line, Kerwin says. They're in the line. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
While it is widely known that many of the world's wealthiest individuals and large corporations have for many years taken advantage of so-called tax havens to avoid paying taxes in their home countries, the identities of many of those people hadn't been exposed until a recent investigation. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists recently revealed that they had obtained 2.5 million files that uncovered the names of more than 120,000 offshore companies and trusts, detailing the activities of celebrities, the super rich, politicians, and many others who use secret bank accounts for the purpose of tax avoidance. The ICIJ report, titled Secrecy for Sale: Inside the Global Offshore Money Maze, made public many of the companies that operate out of tax havens in far-flung places around the world that include the British Virgin Islands, the Cook Islands, Singapore, the Cayman Islands, and Liechtenstein. The records detail the offshore holdings of people and companies in more than 170 countries and territories. The scope of the tax revenue loss is staggering. Last year, a Tax Justice Network investigation found that the super-rich in the U.S. and around the world are hiding at least $21 trillion in offshore accounts, avoiding paying hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes in their home nations. Your reporter spoke with Michael Hudson, senior editor with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, who discusses his group's investigation, its impact, and some of the public policy options available to the international community to prevent the future loss of tax proceeds that fund government programs and services.
Our director, Gerald Ryle, who's a journalist in Australia for many, many years, was working on a big financial scandal there for 3 years, eventually wrote a book about it. It had some offshore elements. And as a result of his reporting, he made contacts, which eventually led him and us to getting the documents. But then we decided when we got the documents and we started looking through them and trying to figure out what's there, we decided we're not going to be a passive conduit. We're not just going to put these out there. We're going to do what we do best and be reporters. So we started looking at what's there and using other documents, court records, and just shoe leather reporting, calling people and double-checking things and making connections between what's in the documents and what's out there in public records to try and do these stories. So we put out a couple dozen stories so far, and we continue to plan on reporting on what we found over the rest of the year.
Michael, what's been the repercussions of the revelation of some of the names that have turned up in this enormous trove of heretofore secret files of those folks with enormous amounts of money in these offshore tax havens? I know that there has been some repercussions in France, but maybe you could summarize some of the other things that have happened as a result of your reporting.
Right. In France, the president went on national television on Wednesday and basically vowed to eradicate tax havens. And the New York Times has given us, ICIJ, at least partial credit for sort of forcing that. In other places like the Philippines, the government, in response to our stories about Ferdinand Marcos's daughter, who is now a provincial governor, about her British Virgin Islands offshore entity, the government has promised to do an investigation to see if her offshore trust holds any money, and if some of that money may have been some of the billions that her father allegedly took out of the country before he lost power. You know, in Mongolia, the deputy speaker of the Mongolian parliament has said, as a result of our reporting on his offshore, his Swiss account and his offshore company, he is considered stepping down. There's an investigation in India of some of the names that we revealed. So there's been a big response. The other response is that the IRS and other tax authorities in Germany and Canada and other places have demanded that we turn over our data to help them track down tax evaders.
And what's been your response to that request for these documents?
You know, our response is we're not an arm of government. As soon as a news organization is perceived as working for the government, our job is to get the information out there, and we are publishing a lot of the documents as we write stories. But, you know, part of what we're doing is we want to investigate these governments, too, and look at how good a job they're doing. So we can't be, you know, working with them or being agents of the government. We have to maintain our independence.
From a reporter's point of view, If you were to recommend changes in our national or the international system of banking to prevent this kind of abuse of secret bank accounts and trillions of dollars out of the reach of legitimate taxation, what are some of the primary things you'd recommend?
Right. I try not to get into recommending specific policy ideas. That's just not my job. I mean, I'll be writing about those and I'll be talking to experts and trying to look at them. As we continue, I mean, I can say that most of the experts, folks who are critics of the offshore world, say that the key thing, or one of the key things, is just making sure that the ownership of companies is something that's transparent. You should be able to go to the British Virgin Islands and find out on the internet or with a phone call and find out who really owns a specific company. If you're thinking about doing business with this company, or you run across this company somehow, or you're a lawyer trying to collect money because of a fraud case, you should be able to find out who owns that company. There shouldn't be a sort of faux director, faux shareholder who's on the official documents actually serving as a front man for the real people behind the company. So that's one thing. And you know, that's a problem not just in the British Islands, but in places like Delaware and Wyoming, which in a sense are sort of internal U.S. tax havens, where it's very hard to find out who's really behind companies. I think the other sort of choke point is you know, the era of for people who are involved in drug dealing or fraud or other crimes, the era of suitcases stashed with wads of, you know, $100 bills, that's over. I mean, money moves by a click of a computer key. So, and that means they go through banks. So even if money is being moved offshore and it's officially held in a trust in the Cook Islands in the South Pacific, it's actually often really in a J.P. Morgan Bank in Manhattan or HSBC Bank in London.
That was Michael Hudson, senior editor with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Find his group Secrecy for Sale Inside the Global Offshore Money Maze report by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The release of President Obama's federal budget proposal last week included a reduction of Social Security benefits totaling an estimated $100 billion or more over 10 years through a change in the way cost of living adjustments are calculated. Many progressive groups around the country have loudly proclaimed their staunch opposition to the proposed change, called the Chain Consumer Price Index, or simply Chain CPI. The White House says the president only supports reductions in Social Security and proposed additional cuts to Medicare benefits if congressional Republicans accept closing tax loopholes that benefit the wealthiest Americans and there are protections in place for the most vulnerable citizens. On April 9th, the day before the budget was to be announced, progressive legislators from the House and Senate, joined by organizers from 15 national groups, gathered in front of the White House to present 2 million petition signatures opposed to Mr. Obama's proposed social safety net cuts. Vermont's independent Senator Bernie Sanders spoke for many when he said, quote, "We're not going to balance the budget on the backs of the elderly, disabled, vets, the sick, or the children." The Progressive Change Campaign Committee supports the election of strongly progressive candidates to Congress and mobilizes activists on their priority issues nationwide. Now the committee has entered the fray in opposition to the president's proposed cuts to Social Security. Your reporter spoke with Adam Green, co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, who discusses his group's threat to launch primary campaigns against congressional Democrats who support the president's proposed reduction of Social Security and Medicare benefits.
So many of our members are on Social Security and Medicare, and we've been talking with them intensely over last week or so since it's become public that the president would actually go forward with this cut to Social Security benefits, a cut that, you know, would impact some people $600, some people $1,000 per year, people on fixed incomes. And, you know, we talked to one guy who told us, you know, "I'm on Social Security and I just paid all my bills for the last month and I have $3.71 left in my bank account." And this really stood out to us because, you know, for people like this, and he's not alone, you know, there's nothing left to cut. And those who think about this as just a math problem, right, so the people who look at this as $200 billion as opposed to $1,000 out of this guy's pocket, which he doesn't have, you know, are missing the really human element of this issue. And when you add to that the context that so many corporations don't pay their fair share in taxes, that millionaires and billionaires don't pay their fair share in taxes, that Mitt Romney pays 14% or less in taxes, it's just tragedy. So, you know, our point is you can't call yourself a Democrat and support cutting Social Security benefits. It's not cutting the fat. It's cutting right into the bone. It's cutting right into the core of the Democratic and progressive legacy. And anyone who's willing to do that shouldn't be running on the Democratic Party line. And that's why we, along with Democracy for America and MoveOn.org, have made clear that any Democrat that supports the president's budget in this respect should be prepared for a primary challenge. And we've actually asked our members, you know, would you be willing to run against your representative, quote unquote, if they vote for Social Security benefit cuts? And 1,300 people have already said yes, including 700 in Democratic districts. And many of our members are local state legislators, school board members, union presidents, small business owners. And, you know, we would go through a methodical process of finding the most credible candidates, choosing our races carefully, and we would, you know, back up the threat with actual candidates.
Adam, what are some alternatives to this idea of chain CPI that would not cut the benefits, but also secure these programs that are not in imminent danger of, you know, falling away tomorrow, but many years in the future? What are some alternatives there?
That's a great question, Scott. And it's definitely, you know, the answer is something that we should all be repeating over and over again to folks who are interested in this issue. So with Social Security, step number one is making clear that there is a $2.5 trillion surplus, and Social Security is solvent. You can pay 100% of the benefits for decades. You know, on the out decades where it would be less solvent, even then it would be able to pay 75% of the benefits. So the idea that we need to cut thousands of dollars away from grandma now in order to avoid cutting thousands of dollars decades from now is, you know, just on its face absurd and really doesn't take into account a lot of things. But for those who want to make it even more solvent, there is a simple one-stop shop fix, and that is what's called scrapping the cap. What is the cap? The cap is right now billionaires like Warren Buffett and George Soros and multimillionaires like Bill Gates only pay Social Security taxes on the first $113,000 of their income. All the rest is tax-free so far as Social Security is concerned. Well, if we eliminated that cap and had them pay Social Security on all of their income or a giant part of their income, that would make Social Security solvent for decades more. So if we can solve the problem for 50 years, I think we're good. Hopefully we'll have some economic growth in there, you know, and you know, we'll never have to cut benefits. So that's Social Security. On the Medicare front, again, we need to distinguish between addressing entitlements and addressing benefits. And the key word for us is benefits, which we define as, you know, money that gets paid out to grandma or veterans or widows or people with disabilities. But that's not the same as being unwilling to look at the structure of our program and actually look for savings. So you mentioned before that chain CPI would, you know, save about $200 billion. Well, with Medicare, we could save $130 billion, actually, with Medicare and Medicaid, by allowing them to negotiate prices with the big drug companies. You know, that would not cut a dime from benefits. It wouldn't be something that progressives need to swallow as part of a grand bargain. It would actually be the outwardly progressive thing to do, right? We'd be stopping corporations from ripping off taxpayers and ripping off our grandparents. There are a number of reforms just like that that summed up would save us hundreds of billions of dollars, and unlike cutting benefits, would actually slow would reduce healthcare costs. And that's the real goal for those who say we need to reform these programs, reducing the actual costs. So it's very important that we go out there, not seem unreasonable by saying that entitlements are off the table, instead make very clear that so far as we're stopping corporations from ripping off taxpayers, we are more than happy to save hundreds of billions of dollars from these programs. And yes, you know, Republicans might attack us like they did in 2010 by accusing us of cutting Medicare, which was ironic, but we shouldn't have the middle ground be that we're actually going to do the wrong thing, which is deprive our grandparents who are on fixed income of thousands of dollars.
That was Adam Green of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. Find links to more news and commentary on growing opposition to President Obama's proposed social safety net program benefit cuts by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. very unusual event unfolded in Superior Court in New Haven, Connecticut over the past couple of weeks. A man took his case to trial rather than plea bargain the charges against him. And on April 12th, a judge declared a mistrial after the jury said they couldn't convict the defendant because the police in the case had also broken the law. Since 98% of court cases are settled by plea bargaining with no trial, the case of J.O. Richardson stands out. The case resulted from a routine traffic stop in 2011, when Richardson, who was African American, fled the scene and led police on a chase across town. He was shot in the chest by one officer and almost killed. Police then charged him with assault on an officer, a charge carrying a penalty of 30 years in prison. Richardson admits to some motor vehicle violations, but says he was determined to fight the assault and attempted assault charges because he maintains his innocence. With solid community support, he was able to hire a private attorney, Diane Polin, who has decades of experience in police abuse cases. She was able to show the jury that the police involved not only violated the city's standing policy of not pursuing individuals in their cruisers unless a serious crime had been committed, but they also ignored three commands from a superior to end the car chase. In declaring a mistrial, Richardson avoided conviction of any of the 10 charges against him. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Diane Polin, Richardson's attorney, who explains why, in her view, a mistrial was even more significant than an acquittal.
I think the reason this case went to trial is that Mr. Richardson was shot in the chest and could have died. And it just didn't sit right with him to plead guilty and accept a jail sentence.
J.O. Richardson told me he felt like the police charged him with assault because they shot him, to cover for having used excessive force.
Well, yes. In my experience, certainly doing plaintiff civil rights litigation, when people are injured by the police, they're almost always charged with assault on a police officer so that, you know, the police can be proactive and not just be defending an excessive force claim. To me, what was most extraordinary about this case is that two members of the jury who are African American ultimately decided that they could not convict Mr. Richardson of any of the 10 charges, even though there was certainly evidence to support some of the motor vehicle charges, because they believed, as they said in a note, that the police broke the law. And the police broke the law by ignoring the written pursuit policy of the New Haven Police Department and by ignoring their supervisor's direct orders to terminate the pursuit, which he gave three different times. I think that was very significant to at least the two members of the jury who refused to convict. In my view, the police pursuit is what caused everything else to happen. Mr. Richardson did drive away from a motor vehicle stop, and he doesn't deny that he did that, but they weren't supposed to pursue him for a broken headlight. And it's the police pursuit that endangered his life, their lives, and the lives of all the innocent civilians, particularly people living in a densely populated section of New Haven.
There's a concept called jury nullification, and it sounds like that's what happened in this case. Can you explain what that is and when that can be used?
You know, jury nullification is a term for what happens when juries are unwilling to convict somebody, notwithstanding some of the evidence. It's not something they're instructed that they're allowed to do, but as people of conscience, they do it sometimes. And in my case, the whole jury didn't do that, but two people who were African American, which I think is very significant to this, said, we can't convict this guy because the police broke the law. It's not an argument I made with respect to the minor charges, but I certainly made that argument with respect to the assault on an officer and attempted assault on an officer charge.
Diane Polin, you said the fact that the jurors who refused to convict Richardson are African American, and that's very significant. How so?
I think this is really a good example of how race really still does matter in this country. And it matters because of the different ways that people in majority white communities and people in majority brown communities experience the police presence in their communities. And it's very different. And these jurors were both selected after extensive voir dire questioning by both sides. Neither of them had a chip on their shoulder. Neither of them hated the police. They were both people who indicated through all of their answers they could be fair, and they were accepted by both the prosecutor and the defense. So there's nothing wrong with these jurors. There's nothing wrong with the selection process. I think what happened is, after hearing all the evidence in the case and hearing about how the police ignored the supervisor's order to terminate the pursuit, you know, how the police violated their own training in the actions they took at the gas station, these jurors, whose own life experiences are as African-American people, they could not convict him. And I think that's very significant, that race still matters.
You've said that this mistrial might be more important than an outright acquittal. Probably not to the defendant, but why do you think so?
Well, I think this is so significant because of what it shows about the different impact of this type of testimony on white and non-white jurors. My experience as a criminal defense lawyer, black jurors are not soft on crime, quite the opposite. They want criminals out of their community. They're often the victim of crime. This is not about solidarity between black jurors and criminal defendants. This has to do with the way in which the police abuse people of color in their own communities, which those people are aware of. That's what this case is about, and I think that message is so important.
J.O. Richardson goes back to court May 8th. What's your guess about whether the state will move to retry him?
You know, I'm going to talk to the prosecutor either on May 8th or before that and try to talk to him about why it's not a good use of resources to retry this case, you know, and hopefully I'll be successful, but I can't promise that.
That was attorney Diane Polin, who defended J.O. Richardson from charges of assault and attempted assault on a police officer, resulting in a mistrial. Find articles detailing the circumstances in this unusual case by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.